one.
Okay, we're looking at an article sent to us by a church member, and we appreciate that. The author's name is David French. It says this piece originally ran in David French's newsletter, The French Press, which means I would have never saw it. It's good. The shame of Uvalde and the sacrifice of Memorial Day. Our nation is stained by cowardice. It is sustained by selflessness. Again, I'll say it. Our nation is stained by cowardice. It is sustained by selfishness. Brian, lead us off in that first paragraph.
So it's been years since I've seen Americans so unified by grief and fury. The grief is for the 19 children and two teachers murdered at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. The fury is against the police officers who waited minute after agonizing minute while the killer hid behind a locked classroom door. The facts are almost too painful to recount. According to the latest timelines, at 11:33 a.m. on Tuesday, March 24th, the Uvalde mass shooter, I've adopted a practice of refusing to name spree killers, entered the school and began shooting into classroom 111 or 112. 2 minutes later, at 11:35 a.m., three Uvalde officers arrived at the closed classroom door. Two were lightly wounded by gunfire from the shooter. Four more officers arrived. Let's pause right here. According to Uvalde police training documents obtained by Mike Baker and Dana Goldstein at the New York Times, this moment should have led to an immediate, sustained, and sacrificial engagement with the shooter. Police, including Uvalde police, are taught to engage a police shooter and not to stop, even if it means taking casualties. Here are some key quotes. First responders to the active shooter scene will usually be required to place themselves in harm's way and display uncommon acts of courage to save the innocent. As first responders, we must recognize that innocent life must be defended. A first responder unwilling to place the lives of the innocent above their own safety should consider another career field. When a man or woman puts on a uniform and straps on a gun, whether they're a police officer or a soldier, they should be making a profound declaration. They're willing to die to protect their community and their nation. They don't want to die, of course, but they're willing to pay the last full measure of devotion if that moment arrives. That's why we respect men and women in uniform. In some cultures, the uniform is a symbol of authority, not sacrifice. And those who wear uniforms are feared far more than they're respected. In our culture, we thank soldiers for their service and back the blue, because in theory, they've placed our lives above their own.
Right, let's pause for a minute. It's just so well written.
And we need to go back and correct something. You said.
Oh, did I misread? Sorry.
It's May 24th.
Sorry.
Yeah, just so in case some fact checkers start listening. But, you know, you said March 24th.
Sorry.
It says May 24th.
May 24th.
May 24th.
The two quotations are pretty incredible. The second one, as first responders, we must recognize that innocent life must be defended. At first responder unwilling to place the lives of the innocent above their own safety should consider another career field.
Well, I'm kind of afraid that I'm not sure about first responders, but and you can speak way more to this with military service. But as I've been here 20 years, I have seen or observed a difference in I suppose the reason people are getting into the military, and more I see or hear people talking. Reasons like, you know, I'm going to get my college paid for and all of those things, which are great benefits that the military offers as an incentive. But I wonder in some way if some of those incentives have attracted people who aren't really there for the cause of laying down their life if need be.
Yeah, the article is going to get into that very idea, John, as we push through it, because that is the struggle, is how to move the innocent, the civilian, into the person who is willing to lay down their life. How to make that change. How do we move that person from you know, day one of basic training, he's not thinking about giving up his life. Day one of police academy, he's not thinking about it. So how do we develop this ethos within a person that they go into the elementary school and they keep advancing toward the enemy and shooting and shooting and shooting until there's no longer a threat, until the threat is neutralized. And that's what failed to happen. I remember when I watched the 60 Minutes on the special on this, I was so emotionally moved at what I'd learned that very first time. This is not the first time I learned this. I just went to Pam and my wife, and I was just like, I just had to get something off my... I was so devastated to find out that they let it go on for almost an hour.
Right.
You know, they were holding back parents who were ready to charge in them themselves to save their own kids' lives, and they were putting their effort in... I mean, it was just... Oh, so difficult. So let's keep reading the article.
And so, at 11:35 a.m., the seven officers present had but one choice: fight to the death to protect and save as many children as they could. They were to emerge from that school with their shield or on it. There was no moral choice. But they waited and waited and waited. Two different girls called 911 begging for help. Their classmates were dead and dying all around them. They were in mortal danger. The first call came at 12:03. That same girl called back at 12:10, at 12:13, and 12:16. A different girl called at 12:19. And the final call came at 12:36.
I mean, just pop. It's hard not to just read that unless you're just like kind of emotionally not moved. Can you just imagine being the 911 dispatch caller, and you're the mediator, you're the go-between between the kids in the classroom and what in the world's happening at the ground zero there, and you're trying to console these children, and you're wondering what are the police officers. Look at the time stamp.
Like, have you all? I don't know about you guys. Like, have you called 911 recently?
No, I haven't.
So, a couple weeks. Well, it's probably a month or two ago now. My wife and I woke up in the middle of the night to the smell of smoke, and so I'm like, I can't find it. And so I'm like,
it was Michael,
well,
wasn't it?
No, it was not. what it ended up happening was the blower motor, one of the fuses in my air handler up in my attic had gone out. And so we had smelled smoke, and I'm like, I can't find it. So we went ahead and called 911 to have the fire department come out in a non-emergency. These timestamps blow my mind. Like, because it's 3, 4 in the morning, and, I mean, I'm calm. I'm like, my house is not on fire. I've looked in my attic. I see nothing, but I want them to, like, yeah, I need a non-emergency fire response. And the lady was flat-out annoying, like, wanting me to, like, and asking for information. And it seems like they're very long phone calls because they're trained, you know, as a dispatcher. But the fact of the same girl calling at 3-minute intervals, you almost wonder, like, did she just, okay, thank you, they're on their way, and then call right back. Like, I mean, I can't imagine that this girl had any time to actually do anything else between these phone calls. So,
the dispatcher, you mean, or the girl?
No, the girl who's, like, in the room. Like, in addition to the dispatcher. I mean, you almost kind of, like, talking about that emotional response to what's going on.
I'm surprised they didn't keep him on the line.
Like, that's another
But
solid
again,
question.
I just can't even imagine being that girl. At this time, families were rushing to the school. Police blocked them from trying to reach their children. The result was ultimate anguish. The videos are hard to watch. At 12:50, the police finally opened the door with a key, charged into a room, and killed the shooter. That was 1 hour and 15 minutes after the first police contact in the school. The timeline from the Daily News... Dallas Morning News tells the story with devastating simplicity. Do we want to go through the timeline?
Yeah, well, before we do, can we... Like this, I know, I'm sure the author will get into some of the tension between here, but he has already addressed the fact of the protecting innocent life over your own. Like, the thought process of these police officers of, I'm not rushing in there to protect innocent life, but I will stand out here and keep other innocent life from endangering themselves because I'm not willing to.
It's really hard. It's
like,
it's hard
one
to think
thing,
about.
And you might know because if you've watched more reports on it, but during like when the police first showed up and they were standing outside the classroom door and he shot at them, was he continuing to shoot students in the classroom, or did he pause and stop and was just hiding in the classroom at that point?
No, he was shooting and not shooting. So
they didn't really know if he was shooting more students or not?
Right, then he would shoot, and then they... So, over the period of time...
Over that, from yes. 12, from 11:35,
right, they weren't all killed at one moment. It happened over the hour.
Right, and I know, yeah, and reading the article, it sounds like, you know, the shooter shot from the outside in, and then he gained access and killed several students and teachers then. What I wasn't clear on just reading the article was at 11:35 when the officers are standing in the hallway, was the shooter, obviously it was like...
Our children continuing to die.
Right, it appears like he was locked at that point, at least in between two classrooms or two adjoining rooms, the what, 111 and 112 or whatever it looked like. So was he just randomly shooting children still or...
It appears that he is.
Okay. Yeah. I guess that was my question,
so
because the police's argument was no children were at risk, which is why they waited, and they were afraid if they rushed in, then other students would be killed.
Which they were.
Right, but if he's continuing to shoot children, students at that point, then, you know, yes, they should have made the attempt to go in anyway.
So, 11:30, teacher calls 911 and reports a car crash and a man with a gun. 11:32, Ramos begins shooting into classrooms from outside the school. 11:33, Ramos enters the school and begins shooting into room 111 or 112. He shoots more than 100 rounds.
Which I don't understand is why, how do they not know which room it was? 111 or 112.
Maybe they're adjoining...
Yeah, if they're connected rooms.
Well, I think that's where he ended up, because then it says the initial caller was in classroom 112.
Which almost would make you think that...
Yeah, maybe they are adjoining.
Yeah. All right, 11:35, three Uvalde Police Department officers enter the school through the door Ramos used, followed by four more. The three officers who first arrived go to the door of the classroom. The door is closed, and two receive grazing wounds from the shooter. 11:37, Ramos fires 16 more rounds. 11:51, police sergeant and sheriff's department agents start to arrive. 12:03, officers continue to arrive in the hallway. 19 officers are in the hallway by this time. 12:03, the first 911 call from inside the classroom from a girl who whispers that she's in room 112. 12:10, the second 911 call. She calls back and says multiple people are dead. 12:13, third 911 call. Same girl calls again. 12:15, more law enforcement arrive with shields. 12:16, fourth 911 call. The same girl calls and says 8 or 9 students are still alive. 12:19, the fifth 911 call. A different girl in classroom 111 calls. She ends the call when another student tells her to hang up. 12:21, Ramos fires again. He's believed to be at the door. Police find 142 rounds of spent cartridges after the shooting ends. 12:36, the sixth 911 call. The initial caller in classroom 112 calls and is told to stay on the line and be very quiet. She says he shot the door. 12:43, she asks 911 to please send the police now. 12:46, she says she can hear the police outside the door. 12:50, law enforcement officers open the door with keys they got from the janitor and they kill Ramos. 12:51, children leave the classroom.
So an hour and 20 minutes.
Well, that's what you mentioned about the staying on the line. That's the first 911 call is at 12:03. It is, which line was it?
12:36.
12:36?
Yeah, she's told to stay on the line.
33 minutes between 911 calls and the operator, the dispatcher, finally tells her to stay on the line.
Police initially attempted to explain this delay by saying they believed there were no kids at risk, but they now acknowledge they made the wrong decision. This horrific police failure occurred 4 years after a similar police failure in Parkland, Florida. Sheriff's Deputy Scott Peterson notoriously stayed outside as a killer rampaged through the halls and school classrooms of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, but seven other sheriff's deputies who raced the school and heard gunshots also stayed outside the building. We can and should investigate failures in our command and control. We should re-examine police training. But we also need to acknowledge that what happened on the ground was that men were afraid, and in that moment, their courage failed. Had the first seven officers pressed in, even as one or more of them fell, we'd still mourn the children who died, and we'd still be torn apart by debates over guns. But in our cultural crisis, we'd know a degree of cultural comfort. Great courage would have been confronted great evil, and we'd be reminded again about what the uniform is supposed to mean. Brian?
You almost wonder, like, as these men, you know, like, yes, it's absolutely tragic, and we can't change the fact that this is tragic. But in that moment, when these, you know, three officers and then four more, so seven officers are there, how much of what's going through their mind is also how much police support our nation has given over the last 3 years?
Or the lack thereof?
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. You know, the lack of courage is probably on two levels. The lack of courage for the bullets coming at me, okay, that's an obvious one. But I think the lack of courage is, I don't want to charge in here, start shooting, and then I'm going to end up on trial.
I hit an innocent, yep. I hit a student by accident, and now I'm going to be in prison.
What happened in Minnesota is...
It's baked in. It's just baked into every situation to which a police responds now. I mean, it's just there.
Yeah, because you not only do you have the situational awareness and the moral or ethical choice, but then also you have the political correctness of how much sensitivity training did these men have to go through, in addition to all their critical training of saving lives and eliminating threats and things like that. That you almost wonder. And I don't know how far out of Dallas is Uvalde.
Oh, quite a ways.
Is it quite a ways? Because I knew it was a rural community, but I was just, I hadn't thought about the connection to Dallas until...
Very rural.
We had seen this timeline, but I was also wondering, which also kind of surprises me as well, that in a rural community, that if that were the case, that would be running through their minds of, how their community would respond to them making a poor choice, but...
What's interesting about that is we live in a time and age when unrealistic expectations in about every situation abound. Okay, so there's the reality is that if I'm deliberate and not going to rush in and make an error, that means I have to trade that deliberate thought for potentially making a mistake. I have to trade that for being quick to also disarm a situation, right? Mm-hmm. So, or on the opposite side, if I'm going to rush in and take out a killer before he can kill more innocent lives, there just stands a better chance that I'm going to rush in, make a quick decision, and make a mistake as well. But we live in a society that wants to believe that you can just be perfect.
Right.
When I'm talking about you.
Right.
But when I'm talking about me, you're going to give me all the grace that you can, because I'm just human, I make mistakes, and it's just so hilarious in a just terrible way that we see this with the demand for morality and being on the right side of history and things like that from a liberal mind, which tells us all the time there is no morality, there is no absolute truth. And so once again we just underscore the fact that we've got minds that are not thinking rationally, because what this document is saying in the training is you're making a trade. If you put on this uniform, you might have to give up your life. And if you're not willing to give up your life, don't put on this uniform. I mean, that's what that training document said.
Yep. Yeah.
And because the training document is reality. It realizes you're never going to be able to rush in, make a 2-second decision, and make a perfect decision. It's not going to happen. And you've been, in the military and, under fire and other issues. And you just know that nothing ever goes the way you plan. There's always stuff you don't know behind that door, behind the next bend. I mean, But we've got this false reality, I think, a lot of times because of movies and other media, mm-hmm. that you can just make perfect decisions, boom, 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 all the time.
Well, I think it just comes down to everybody wants to second guess. You know, it's the Monday morning quarterback, whether it's your favorite sports team, your favorite or least favorite politician, your anyone in authority. You know, everybody's going to second guess them. And, you know, whether it's a pastor or, you know, why didn't you say this instead of that? Why did you use that as an example and not this as an example? Why did you put that picture up and not this other picture? And, you know, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you rush in? Why did you rush in and shoot this? And it's like no matter what you do in an authoritative, as an authority, somebody's going to second guess you and try to shoot you down.
Well, and even in this particular situation, the author addressed it on the very first page of police, including Uvalde police, are taught to engage a police shooter and not to stop, even if it means taking casualties. Our, you know, Jonathan, like what you're talking about is our world has forgotten the reason why that word casualties exists to refer to innocent lives that are taken in a critical situation like that. Is there is a chance that someone might die. And as long as it was not premeditated and deliberate, there is an understood awareness that sometimes this happens because we're not perfect and they're making critical decisions at a critical point in time and we're all flawed humans. So the author goes on, as I wrote after the Parkland School massacre, cultivating courage is a complex and difficult task. Some cultures are better at it than others. And absolutely no sane nation or institution relies on the inherent goodness or bravery of their police or military to sustain their civilization. It's a simple fact that when men or women face mortal danger, every single molecule in their bodies screams at them to seek shelter and safety. It takes immense effort to overcome the desire for self-preservation. Training can help, but it isn't enough. What's required is a fundamental, deep-embedded ethos, a core understanding that love may require their lives. Parents possess this ethos almost as a matter of instinct. Intelligent armies construct this ethos by building bonds between brothers in arms. Dying for a nation is an abstract concept when bullets fly. Risking everything for the brothers beside you? That makes immediate, visceral sense. I won't say that everyone I served with in Iraq was brave, but I cannot imagine my brothers failing me in a moment of crisis, and I pray that I would never fail them. At the root of a failure of courage is often a failure of love. C.S. Lewis wrote that courage is not simply one of the virtues, but the form of every virtue at its testing point. Jesus said, "No one has greater love than this, to lay down his life for his friends." What we witnessed from the police in Uvalde was the triumph of self-love over love of others, including the young kids bleeding in that room. At the testing point, the officers were confronted with a question, "Whom do you love?" "I love me," they responded, and they stood down. Mm. That declaration of "I love me" is endemic in our nation. And it's not just endemic when lives are on the line. It's dreadful to read the comprehensive report on the Southern Baptist Convention's Executive Committee's response to abuse allegations and understand exactly how much of the misconduct was driven by the desire for self-preservation. Preserve the assets of the ministry. Preserve the power of the leaders. As my wife Nancy continued her tireless investigation of the Connacook camp in Missouri, writing most recently in USA Today about decades of abuse involving multiple predators, you can see the same desires in play. Protect the leaders, protect the camp, justice is secondary. Accountability is a threat. At the testing point, these institutions were confronted with a question, "Whom do you love?" "We love us," they responded, and they covered it up. The cross utterly rebukes this ethos. Jesus could not be more clear. If anyone wants to follow after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And with this command comes a warning and a promise. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life because of me will find it. It's a terrible irony the police failure in Uvalde occurred less than 1 week before Memorial Day. I hope that we can pause for just a moment on Monday and remember that those who who died directly confronting a suicide bomber in Iraq. And remember those who did not stand down. I'm remembering my men like my friend Mike Metters, who died directly confronting a suicide bomber in Iraq. I'm remembering my friend Tor Mallard, who always led the front until an IED claimed his life and the life of three other brothers in a Humvee in 2008. Our nation still produces such men and women, and one way to continue to cultivate courage is to remember them, honor them, and teach the next generation to emulate them. Yes, condemn cowardice, but also celebrate valor. Remember our nation that its heroes remind our nation that its heroes made a better choice. At the testing point, they were confronted with the question, "Whom do you love?" "We love you," they responded, and they went in. Our nation is sustained by sacrifice. It is strained and stained by cowardice. May the shame of Uvalde shake us from our national malaise. May the memory of our fallen call us back to our highest ideals, and may God have mercy on us all.
It's a good article. We wanted to share it with you today because it's worth your attention to contemplate, who do you love? And most of us are not going to be called to give our lives in the rescuing of mass citizens in a crisis situation like this. But in reality, all four of us at this table, Mike's gone for the day, but all four of us are continually confronted with, who do I love? Do I love myself more than my wife? Do I love myself more than my children? Do I love myself more than my church? It's a daily thing, John. Mm-hmm. Who do I love the most? Am I going to take the trash out with a bad attitude because I love myself more than I love my wife? It's really fundamental.
Right, and it's very linear, and what I mean by that is you don't become a hero in one day.
Right.
You know, you mentioned just such a mundane thing like taking out the trash. If you don't realize occasionally, like when you're having a bad attitude like this, this is a fundamental problem that I've got, and what I'm doing is I'm training myself to not be a hero someday.
Right.
You know, then you need to wake up, because the reality is, every time you serve somebody else, you're making it a habit. There's something, you know, yes, we talk about, you know, pie in the sky stuff. We talk about, you know, theories and philosophies. But the reality is many habits are just trained through just doing things, little simple repetitive tasks over and over and over.
Well, right.
And yourself.
Right. I mean, that's police officers have to train to respond to mass shooter situations, because they're not going away. That's what we've learned in our lifetime. They're not going away. So every city in this, every state should have drills in which soldiers have to go into situations, whether they do rubber bullets, whatever they do, and just do it like it's for real because it's not natural to run to the bullets. It's not natural to shoot to where someone's shooting at you. But the innocents are counting on the very fact that there are men and women who have the courage to sacrifice their life to protect them. That's how they go to school with some semblance of... I mean, these kids that survived are going to be traumatized for a very long time. This whole school.
Well, you also think about the community. I mean, how does, and you know, even the officers that maybe showed up at 12:36 or 12:45, how does anyone wear a Uvalde police uniform after this?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I mean, like, Texas is, for the most part, Texas is a very patriotic state. Very, you know, very traditional, very supportive of police. I mean, it's not one of those communities where you heard a lot of defund the police talk. But you just think about how these parents are going to interact with police officers now.
No, man, you can't even imagine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then how does it get better in that community? How does anyone sign up in the next 2 years to go to the police academy for Uvalde?
Right. Yeah. Really hard situations. We pray that God would have mercy upon those families, that He would comfort them in their loss. We pray that those that are grieving, I mean, I just can't even fathom being a police officer and then having to live for the rest of your life knowing that the 25 minutes that you delayed or the 30 minutes you delayed, there are children that would have been alive had you taken a more aggressive act. Really tough situation. Tough article to read. Well done. Thank you for sharing it with us. And we pray we've given you something to think about and to be edified by. Thanks for listening. Have a great 4th of July weekend.